This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
We're going to have a mock trial, and if we find the Democrats, like we did the Republicans, guilty of crimes against humanity, we're going to announce those things, and we will have an arrest warrant.
The Poor People's Army resolves to march to the steps of the Democratic National Convention, despite Chicago authorities' attempts to reroute them.
This is a psychological operation to confuse the Venezuelan people, destabilize the country, and create vulnerabilities so that the choice of the majority of the Venezuelan people will not be allowed to continue in office.
International election observers report on Venezuela's presidential election.
It's not just, ooh, there's this cool product and now I can talk into it and ChatGPT. It's that so many people have been harmed, so many people have passed away, and this technology isn't even ready to be put out.
Activists denounce the use of artificial intelligence to further exploit working people.
This was all coordinated. It had a specific goal, which is to take out some very big names within the Axis of Resistance and to signal to the Axis of Resistance, to the Palestinians, and to the world that there would be no negotiations to end the genocide in Gaza.
Is Israel trying to provoke a wider war in the Middle East? From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ian Garrison. In July, the Philadelphia-based Poor People's Army marched on the Republican National Convention, where longtime poor and homeless activist Sherry Hoggla was arrested. They are now planning to march on the Democratic National Convention in Chicago on August 19th. I spoke to Sherry Hoggla. Sherry, tell us about what you experienced in Milwaukee at the Republican National Convention.
When I was in Milwaukee at the Republican National Convention, I went to serve an arrest warrant on Trump and the Republican Party for crimes against humanity.
Okay.
And I was arrested. I was arrested, and I've been arrested, you know, over 200 sometimes doing nonviolent civil disobedience. And I just figured I would be taken down to one of the stations and given a court date or a fine or something. And instead, they took me to like this warehouse building. And then from the warehouse building that looked like an office building on the outside, they put me in a prison bus and took me to the old House of Corrections in Milwaukee, which was about a half hour away. And then when I got there, they opened up the door for me to go into the prison. I was the only prisoner. And there was 200 military police officers. I've never had that experience before. And I don't know why I needed to be taken someplace with 200 military police officers. It was quite frightening. They took me to a back area where there was, you know, glass windows. And I laid on the floor and went to sleep. And then when they got me up, they put me into another form of transport and drove me to the middle of an industrial area where there was just like warehouses and storage places in the middle of the night, in the middle of a really bad storm where there was like lightning and thunder and pouring rain. And they opened up the side of the bus and they told me just to get out. And so then I just walked.
You had no money and no phone, right?
I had no money. I had no phone. And so I just walked towards the light. I figured that's an area with people in it. And I walked to a Mexican restaurant and I asked a woman who was very nice if I could use her cell phone. She could dial the number for me. And then I had people come and pick me up. So I've never been incarcerated with 200 military police officers. And I've never been dropped in a warehouse district in a populated city in the middle of a storm. So that was really really uncalled for, really outrageous, and really is an expression of the new times that we're living in right now.
The 200 military police officers, were they there just to meet you? Or was this a force that was in town, especially for the convention? Or what was that about?
Well, I'm sure that they were in town for the convention, but they weren't doing anything but sitting at tables in a huge room. And that's where they took me through. Is I was the only prisoner in the entire place. And they walked me through those 200 military police officers.
And were you booked?
Yes, I was booked. I was fingerprinted and, you know, my information was taken and yeah.
So do you have a court date?
No. At the end of the night, they gave me a citation.
So you have to pay a fine?
Yep, I have to pay a fine.
Okay. So did you and your group have the support of other people protesting against the war in Gaza and police brutality or whatever else?
Yes. Actually, the very first thing that we did when we arrived is we were a part of organizing the People's First Convention, and that was people from around the entire country. We had it at the Casablanca because an hour before the event, the day before the end of the day, the city pulled the permit for the event. So we had to scramble, and some speakers didn't get notified of the change of the venue. And it was really hard and crazy, but it turned out to be very successful. There was Palestinian rapper, a lot of folks from the Palestinian community, from the Mexican community, the African-American community, all of us coming together and uniting around the fact that something very different has to happen in this country. And we weren't just talking about Republicans. We were also talking about the other corporate-controlled political party, the Democrats.
Now you're going to march from Milwaukee. Well, you're going to march from Milwaukee to Chicago starting on August 3rd, right?
Yes, we're marching August 3rd from King Park. We'll have a little vigil there for the gentleman that was murdered by the police the day after we left our encampment.
A Black homeless?
Yes, a Black homeless man. And so we will march from King Park anywhere from 8 to 10 miles a day. The route will be on our website. People can follow along. They can join us. And we intend to talk to people as we march along. We'll have various different stops. We're going to have educationals on the march. We're going to have press conferences on the march. And we're going to march 90 miles. We'll land in Chicago. On the 18th, we have a concert. That's also on our website. There's various different styles of music. There's Peach the rapper, Rebel Diaz is performing, and many other groups. And then on the 19th at 4 p.m. in Humboldt Park, we will kick off the march to the front doors of the Democratic National Convention at 4 p.m. And we were given a permit by the city of Chicago. And we intend to march to the front doors. We're going to have a mock trial. And if we find the Democrats, like we did the Republicans, guilty of crimes against humanity, we're going to announce those things. And we will have an arrest warrant. And we will try to enact that arrest warrant.
You got this permit because you applied and they denied it. And then you appealed and the city failed to respond to the appeal in time. Have they tried to cancel that permit since?
Just today, we got word that they want to have a conversation with us later this week. So we'll have to keep people updated and informed. We're just going to practice our First Amendment rights. We have a track record going back to the year 2000 of having massive marches of upwards of 10,000 people. And we have never been responsible for any kind of violence. And so I anticipate, or would hope, that the city of Chicago or the federal government will not violate our First Amendment rights, especially at a time right now when the only thing that homeless people and poor people have is our voices, because every other thing is being taken away, especially with the recent ruling in the Supreme Court, which basically has criminalized just being alive and being homeless in America. So hopefully they won't try and make a maneuver to take away our voice.
So what are you going to do if they say we're pulling this permit and rerouting you, and we just have the right to do this despite the law. I mean, as I understand it, the law now gives you the right to march to the front door.
Yeah. Well, we really believe strongly that we have done everything in good conscience. We applied for our permit. They gave us our permit, and we are going to follow the original route that we gave the city and march to the front doors.
Okay. Will you be camping in one of the parks? They originally offered Grant Park, which is 3 miles from the convention, and recently in a concession to the march on the DNC 2024, they allowed them to rally in Union Park and have a closer route, but the coalition still doesn't think that route is good enough. But anyway, are you going to be camping in one of the parks, either in Grant Park or Union Park?
Well, we're going to be practicing our First Amendment rights, because even setting up an encampment right now is an act of protest, and the way that we need to speak out right now because of the recent rulings in the Supreme Court, basically making it illegal to exist in encampments in this country. And we don't have money to stay at the Hilton or the Sheraton or any place like that. So we've been setting up encampments for decades, and we intend to do it during the Democratic National Convention.
Will you have medics and lawyers along the way when you're marching from Milwaukee to Chicago?
Yeah, we have lots of different supporters, and we need even more. If somebody has any kind of background in first aid or medical, or we had a nice group of amazing lawyers in Milwaukee, and I know that many lawyers have already signed up, to be legal monitors and to assist us. So I'm sure we'll just be fine.
Okay, lastly, you live in one of the toughest neighborhoods in the U.S., Kensington, Philadelphia. Could you tell us about the conditions that you're protesting there?
Yeah, President Trump himself invited a gentleman to speak at the RNC because my neighborhood is one of the worst in America, but we don't have the same path that brings a solution. They're about locking people up and not providing necessary services and stuff. Every day that I go out my front door, every night that I come home, there's ambulance, there's people being carried away that have overdosed and died. There's constant shootings. I have helicopters above my house, and kids in this neighborhood suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder because it really is a war zone, and something has to be done about it. And the thing that all of these human rights violations have in common is they can all be prevented. More people have died as a result of the opiate crisis than died during the Vietnam War. And billions of dollars have come in around supposedly helping with recovery programs and housing and all of those kinds of things. And it never makes it to the people. So something really has to fundamentally change in this country. And those of us that are part of the Poor People's Army, we've put together a book called Takeover, A Human Rights Approach to Housing. And it teaches people how to take over abandoned government-owned properties in order to house themselves and stay alive. And we really think that we can't wait for either of these corporate-controlled political parties to save us anymore. We've got to start saving ourselves.
Okay. Given all that, what made you decide that you wanted to march in the conventions, given that you feel like people have to give up on power and figure out how to take care of themselves?
I think that we have a responsibility when reporters come into one area from around the world. This is our one shot, so that even if other press don't listen to us here in this country, they might listen to us from other places around the world. And so we are going to be out there on public display, lifting up our voices, doing anything that we can possibly do in order to be heard, because we're not going to be on CNN or the cover of some magazine next week. And that's why we think news reporters like yourself are incredibly important, because this is the only way that the truth gets out there.
That was Sherry Honkola of the Philadelphia-based Poor People's Army. Their website is poorpeoplesarmy.org.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on Report from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised.
That was Gil Scott-Heron, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Next, Pacifica's Polina Vasilyev reports on the presidential election in Venezuela.
On Sunday, July 28th, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro was reelected to a third term in office in a showdown with United Opposition candidate Edmundo González. With a 60% turnout, Maduro received 52% of the vote and González 43%. The U.S. and its allies decried the results, recognized the opposition leader, and demanded negotiations for a, quote, peaceful transition of power, end quote. The Alliance for Global Justice organized a delegation of activists from the U.S., Costa Rica, and Canada who traveled to Venezuela to learn about the Bolivarian Revolution underway there since 1999 to accompany the Venezuelan people and social movements during the July 28 election and to report to people in their countries about what they witnessed. Here are excerpts of a press conference they held in Caracas on July 29th.
My name is William Camacaro. I'm a member of the Alliance for Global Justice and Venezuelan Solidarity Network. We are here in Caracas, Venezuela, with a delegation organized by the Alliance for Global Justice. In a moment that's extremely critical, a presidential election, historical presidential election, that right now is under attack by the right-wing group in Venezuela. We want basically to read a statement from our group in Spanish and English. We also will have several members of the group giving their opinion about what they have been able to see over here in Caracas, in Venezuela, but also their opinion about this behavior that the opposition have at every single election, especially in the last election in the country. So now we have Michael Brown from Minnesota Peace Action Coalition.
Thank you. The first thing I want to do is thank the people and government of Venezuela for inviting us to witness this historic election. We were able to go to many of the polls and observe the voting by the people of Venezuela. The corporate media, the Western media, will continue to try to discredit the election that took place here. But we saw firsthand how the electoral system here works, and fraud is the farthest thing from what could happen. We saw various ways in which the electoral system is audited, both for the people and for the government. This was about something much more than a presidential election, though. This was about a choice between Western imperialism and the struggle of people for freedom. And in this case, the struggle for freedom won. The Western imperialism, which is led by the United States, and the struggle against that is what unites all people who want freedom, whether it be in Venezuela, in Cuba, in Nicaragua, or in Palestine. Thank you.
Now is Jill Clark. She is from Nicaragua Solidarity Coalition. I just want to mention that right now there is a number of protests in the street in Venezuela and Caracas, and they are looking for a coup d'etat against the democratically elected President Nicolás Maduro. So we are denouncing from here also the intent of a coup right now taking place against the Venezuelan government.
Thank you, William. It has been an honor to witness this electoral process that the people of Venezuela have so meticulously developed and implemented, and which is something that has been repeated 30 times during the 25 years of the Bolivarian Revolution. My fellow delegates here and myself have been very moved to see the people of Venezuela coming out in the streets for campaign rallies. On Thursday, we saw the close of the campaign with hundreds of thousands of people in the street in what was really an atmosphere of joy and peace. And we also were very moved to see on Sunday the long lines with hundreds of people at the 6 or 7 polling places that we visited. We saw a process that took place in a very orderly fashion with a very friendly atmosphere. We were able, as Michael described, to see a very sound and secure electoral system, which has been lauded, we believe rightfully so, as one of the most transparent and tamper-proof electoral systems in the world. And we are dismayed. As William has said here, we are now witnessing an attempted coup. But it did not start today. It did not start last night. It started months ago. And as a resident and citizen of the United States, I am very ashamed to say that my government is leading that process, much to the chagrin of the people of the United States who would like to see the Venezuelan people allowed to live in peace. And it is very hypocritical that the Democratic Party that currently leads the administration in the White House in the United States, that has been so critical of Donald Trump's attempt to undermine democracy by questioning the results of the United States election in 2020, which does not by any means have the reputation or the security that the Venezuelan election system has, but the United States government, the Biden administration, is leading and chiming in on these efforts to doubt the integrity of the vote and the vote count in Venezuela. And this is, we need to call this what it is. This is a psychological operation to confuse the Venezuelan people, destabilize the country, and create vulnerabilities so that the choice of the majority of the Venezuelan people will not be allowed to continue in office.
Yeah. We want also, again, to denounce that we are living right now in Venezuela, intent of coup against President Maduro. And we are inviting also the social movement in the United States to show the solidarity to the Venezuelan Revolution at this critical moment. It is extremely important that people in the United States mobilize in solidarity with Venezuela and with its people. Now we have Richard Holt. He is executive director of Agenda Humana, and also immigration activity at the group?
Attorney. As executive director of Human Agenda in San Jose, California, which is really the heart of Silicon Valley, where we have 10,000 homeless in our county alone, I can say that we have witnessed a growing movement in Venezuela to deal with the inequality of global capitalism and to make sure that there are clean and verified elections in Venezuela. I have been an observer many times in Mexico, Honduras, and El Salvador, and the elections that I witnessed here at many polling booths and voting centers were very clean, fair, and verifiable, and they have been verified also. As an immigration attorney concerned about immigration, we know that over the last years, many Venezuelans have left Venezuela. In fact, President Maduro mentioned that there was a 130,000 inflation rate 5 years ago in 2019. However, I think we all need to understand that there's been a transformation in the economy of Venezuela, and that's why the majority of Venezuelans voted for Maduro. First of all, we have to understand that there are 3,600 communes, 49,000 communal councils, and 4,500 new projects that are supporting the basic needs of the Venezuelan people. Projects that over time increasingly have addressed the needs of the people of Venezuela. The foreign investment to Venezuela has increased, and in the last 6 months, $24 billion has been attracted to Venezuela. For the first time, Venezuela has 100% food sovereignty. They are not importing food from other countries. With this transformation, I think we can see why there are more Venezuelans returning to Venezuela than Venezuelans leaving Venezuela. For every 300 Venezuelans that are entering the United States, entering Venezuela, only 200 are leaving right now. So immigration has reversed itself, the economy has reversed itself, and the political system is a clean, verifiable system. We need to support these results because they are verified, and I'm sure that as time will show, this election was the cleanest that could possibly exist in the world. Thank you.
The last word of the group, of this group, this delegation from the United States is to our friends in the United States, please show your solidarity with the Venezuelan Revolution. It's time. The situation is critical right now in Venezuela. There is an intent of coup d'etat against President Maduro. Let's organize and let's show solidarity. Thank you.
Those were the voices of activists with the Alliance for Global Justice speaking in Caracas, Venezuela on July 29, 2024. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken congratulated Edmundo González for quote-unquote winning the July 28th vote, while Russia, China, Belarus, Serbia, Iran, Turkey, Syria, Azerbaijan, North Korea, Vietnam, Madagascar, Namibia, Bolivia, Cuba, Nicaragua, Eritrea, and others recognized the results and congratulated President Maduro for his victory. For Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, I'm Polina Vasilyev.
That was Ali Primera, El Gallo Pinto. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. The introduction of tech into education was supposed to help students, but much of it has been detrimental, according to former charter school teacher Adrienne Williams, who is now with the Distributed AI Research Institute. She spoke at a recent meeting on artificial intelligence and labor in Oakland, California.
I started organizing. I was working for a tech-run and operated charter school, something I had no idea about. They had this personalized learning system that has now become the gold standard. It was a CZI Zuckerberg school. They have 11 of them up and down the West Coast. And what I started realizing when I was working there is that, one, there's no such thing as personalized learning. There literally is not. My kids did the same projects. They did the same lessons. The only thing they got to control is when they turned it in. So I had a bunch of 12-year-olds who got assignments in September and turned them in May. That was about the gist of it. They weren't learning. And the physical component of that is that my kids were suffering from back pain, neck pain. They were getting migraines. Their eyesight was breaking down because they were online 5 hours a day and expected to do 2 hours of online homework. Their agitation levels were through the roof. It was a horrible system, and yet now it's being pushed into nearly every public school and charter school. So whether you shut charter schools down or not, they've still got all this technology in the regular public schools. And what the research is finding is that on average, whether it's a private school or a public school or a charter school, these schools have on average about 19 different ed tech products within the school. And usually with the private schools with more money, their admin has time to vet them, time to make sure that there's not, you know, they're not a bad company that's selling a bunch of data, or they're not, you know, they don't have a bunch of breaches. But when you get to the lower levels with superintendents and really vulnerable communities, they don't have the time for that. And so a lot of them have products that don't work well, that are getting breached constantly. Our government hasn't put anything in place to keep those kids safe, to keep the family safe, to keep the staff safe. And they're really painting this picture that if you don't have this technology, then your child will not be educated, which couldn't be further from the truth. Teachers know how to teach. And what we're doing is we're eliminating the care work out of teaching. This is why these schools are getting more violent. It's why you have more kids dropping out. And then their answer is like, well, we need more cops. But the thing is, what they need is just more people. What I knew with my kids is that sometimes what they just needed is to say, how are you doing today? I'm so happy you're here. And that could change a kid's day. But what's happening now, and Zuckerberg has been very vocal about, we don't need teachers. What we need is facilitators. So they want kids lined up on computers with a facilitator that just keeps them in line. So it's very much like a prison situation and not a healthy educational situation. So I tried to organize with that. It's, you know, who am I to take on as one person? I'm trying to take on Meta. That doesn't work. And so my bright idea is I'm going to go and drive for Amazon. And then, like, instantly, because I thought, you know, it's a solo gig. I'll get my head together. I'll figure out a better job. Instantly, I'm seeing the same lack of respect for health and safety rules, the same surveillance, the same, you know, harming workers. It was interesting to find two industries that were so different that were doing the same thing when it came to technology. So I started organizing there too, and now I work for an organization called the Distributed AI Research Institute, or DARE, and my focus is artificial intelligence and labor exploitation and artificial intelligence and education exploitation. And I find that they very much go hand in hand. And so first, what I like to try to understand is, like, when people hear AI, what is it they're thinking? Because you can be in a room of 20 people and talk, say, AI, and each person has a different idea of what that means. So are you talking about, you know, what he's talking about with the writing? Are you talking about speech to text? Are you talking about facial recognition or expression recognition? There's so many aspects to what AI is that word itself, AI, is just like a blanket, you know, statement that doesn't really have a lot of meaning. It's just this generic statement about all these new technologies. And so when I work on issues around AI and labor exploitation, as much as it is a problem that jobs are going away to automation, another issue that I don't think people realize is that it's not just that the jobs are going away, but it's that as individuals, we don't have the ability to own our data, and we don't understand what the data is for. And data is money. Data is what is fueling all these new industries, all these new technology products, and yet we give it away willingly when it's worth a lot of money. So as we get into this issue of, like, universal basic income, I used to be all on board with that, and now I'm very conflicted because I'm like, okay, so the tech companies are going to be billionaires, and then they're going to dole out an allowance to us, and we just have to deal with it. And that feels to me like a lot of control that we're giving corporations to say, well, we're going to keep everybody on this financial level, and we're going to make sure you get the bare minimum so you don't die, but not enough so you can fight against us and push for a better life. The other part of it is that what workers are doing many times is their initial job, and I am doing a research project right now on the wage theft of Amazon delivery drivers based on the third-party, like, fleet safety apps, and what we're finding is it feels to me like more of a way to train their AI and their algorithms than it is about safety. So it's digital discipline, and then it's how do we train our systems. The work we're doing with drivers, because they have one app that goes on your phone, and that app has already said, you, in order to use it, you have to run it all the time. You have to let us run all the time in the background. So that's tracking you all the time. The other part is the AI cameras. And they say that's for, you know, safety. I haven't found it's made anyone safer. I feel like it makes drivers uncomfortable. If it's too hot outside to eat your lunch outside, you have to take all your breaks, all your lunches inside the van. You can't take a phone call. You can't do anything without Amazon knowing about it. The other aspect of that is that they have AI cameras on the outside. So there is a technology called 3D high definition maps. And the race to get a fully functioning autonomous vehicle is really based on this idea of I have to get every inch of the entire city, county, country recorded and that data put in. And this is how I'm going to get the autonomous vehicles to work. The cameras that are used on the Amazon vehicle are a third-party company called Netradyne. And Netradyne has been very vocal about, we have mapped the most data, you know, road data than any other country in the world. And now they partner with car companies who say straight up, like Hyundai is one of the people they partnered with who says, we can't afford to pay the amount of surveyors and put out the amount of equipment that it would cost to train an autonomous vehicle. But Netradyne here has it for free. And so we're going to not pay anybody. We're going to get that information and we're going to build our own autonomous vehicles. And so there's the driver who's getting paid $17 to $20 an hour, and that's their upfront job. And then they have this invisible job of being AI trainers. And that's, I mean, this is going to be the next iteration in vehicle technology. It's going to be huge if they can get it to work, and yet the people who are actually creating the technology are not getting paid. And so I think if drivers understood what their role is in this, they'd be way more willing to say, oh no, I'm not driving anything until you pay me more than $20 an hour and you give me some damn bathroom breaks. You know, like they're gonna want stock options. They're gonna wanna be compensated for the work they do. And there's precedent to say that this is forced labor. So if you look at our Homeland Security website, they talk about what is forced labor. And some of it is like your normal stuff, right? If you're kidnapped and forced to work, if you're kept in a room or kept somewhere and not allowed to move, you're forced to work. But there's another part that says, if you hire someone for a real job and then force them to do an invisible job they're not aware of, that is also forced labor by way of fraud. And so that's happening not just to drivers, it's happening to warehouse workers, it's happening to school children because they're absolutely stealing all their data when they're on these platforms, these personalized learning platforms. It's happening to nurses, it's happening to almost everybody in a care field because they're trying to not only get rid of them, but then in order to get rid of them, I have to learn their job. And I have to get all these data points so that my AI can try to do their job. This technology doesn't even work. So facial recognition does not work. The darker and more female your face gets, it doesn't work. Expression recognition doesn't work. Even the writing apps doesn't work. You tell it to tell me how to do this thing, and if it doesn't know how to do it, it's just gonna make it up. So you have psychologist apps that are telling people to go kill themselves. You have people with eating disorders who the app is telling them, like, you better stop eating. All the things that a therapist would not say, it's saying to people. The dangers involved are real. And, you know, in the U.S., because we have so-called, you know, like forced labor laws, it's more insidious and more strategic and under our noses. But if you go to other countries, they don't care how it hurts other people. So they're having people like content moderators, and what that is somebody who goes in and watches, you know, videos, looks for hate speech, weeds that out so that we in Western countries don't have to see these horrible images. But if you go to places in Syria, Yemen, Venezuela, Kenya, they're having content moderators do this for maybe $1 an hour. In Venezuela, they're literally paying these content moderators in Amazon gift cards. You can't pay your rent with an Amazon gift card, right? And when you think of a content moderator, it sounds very, like what the companies want you to think is, well, the AI taught this. They want you to think it's like algorithms teaching algorithms. That's not what's happening. There's people behind all of it. All of it is people. The AI cannot think, it cannot learn, it cannot empathize, it does not do that. But the companies want you to think that. And so when you think of like, okay, what is a content moderator moderating? It's every murder, every suicide, every domestic violence, every child abuse, all the hate speech. You have workers having to sit there and make a determination within 60 seconds of, is this acceptable or should we take it off? And yet they're getting paid. And so with Meta especially, there's really cause for human trafficking because they put out this call to say, come work here. Like example with Kenya, you had people saving up money to hop on a bus to then go work at these, you know, basically just like factories, like computer factories, where they sit there, they stare at the computer, and they make these determinations. It's causing people horrible mental harm, because how much of that can you watch? I've seen one video one time where it was horrible, and it stuck with me forever. They have to make a determination within 60 seconds. So how much is that in an 8-hour day that they're watching? They cannot hire, they don't make enough money to have therapy. The company doesn't provide therapy, and they can't even afford to get a bus ticket home. So they are stuck. They have nowhere to go. You have workers killing themselves because it's so traumatizing. And that part of it is usually outsourced, because if we had Americans doing that, you know, you would hear more about it and we would care more about it. I think there just needs to be an understanding of how it works, who it harms, and what actually works for us. There's always a lot of talk about, like, what's the end product? What's the end product? There's not a lot of talk on how it hurts workers, but there's also not a lot of talk on, like, how it hurts workers outside of the U.S. And so when I think of it, I kind of compare it to, like, blood diamonds, right? The diamond itself is not evil, but the way in which it's gathered, the way in which it's collected is very much evil. And we need to figure out, I think, like, where do we actually, I don't feel like we've ever really established in our country or anywhere else in the world, like, where do we actually fall on forced labor? Where do we actually fall on slavery? Because it's not just, ooh, there's this cool product and now I can talk into it and ChatGPT. It's that so many people have been harmed, so many people have passed away, and this technology isn't even ready to be put out. So if it was a medication, you would test it. And if you found something that harmed people, you'd pull it back. You'd work on it some more. You'd make sure it worked and didn't kill people or hurt people or lose jobs. But with AI, it's just, here's a product, I love it, go put it out. And we are all the test subjects. The workers are the test subjects.
That was Adrian Williams with the Distributive AI Research Institute. Yo, homie, I was taught by a Chicago teacher. I learned to read and write from a Chicago teacher. So I'm inspired by the fight from my Chicago teachers. Homie, I was taught by a Chicago teacher. I learned to read and write from a Chicago teacher. So I'm inspired by the fight from my Chicago teachers. The teachers are tired, the students dumbfounded. The budgets get cut, so classes are overcrowded. Streets full of violence, the blue coat is silence. So I'ma keep rhyming till salaries start rising. The unions are rising, taking to the streets. The workers are united, so the mayor's got beef. Rhyme's a fake pretender with a corporate agenda. Neoliberal offender, of course you offend us. This ain't about money, that's far from the truth. They want better work conditions to teach the youth. Politicians, I don't trust them, it's all in the name. The president, the mayor, all want political gain. They'd rather put the kids in jail, shackle them with chains, than provide an education that challenges the brain. Top-down education, Chicago the birthplace. Now it's spreading nationwide all over the place. They don't teach us how to think, they teach us how to test. They teach us how to work to put money in their checks. The CEOs need to get up out the classroom before these streets get hotter than the sand in Cancun. So join the picket line like Mr. Pickett in his prime. Put on your red shirt like the Bulls in 95. Hit the streets with a sign to say I'm fighting for mine. It's a fork in the road and you gotta choose a side. And yes, I'm proud to say I was a public school student. It was public school teachers that first taught me music. And yes, I'm proud to say I was a public school student. A public school teacher first taught me music. Homie, I was taught by a Chicago teacher. I learned to read and write from a Chicago teacher. So I'm inspired by the fight from a Chicago. That was Rebel Diaz, Chicago teacher. Next, Laith Maruf, creator of Free Palestine TV, journalist and political commentator based in Beirut, Lebanon, joined the Activist News Network to discuss the latest Israeli and U.S. escalation of violence in the Middle East.
So first of all, Laith, again, we wanted to start off asking you about the two Israeli attacks in Beirut and Tehran. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh was killed in Tehran on Wednesday, July 31st, in an operation which was attributed to Israel by Iran. And then on Tuesday, July 30th, Israel had claimed responsibility for a strike in Beirut targeting Fuad Shakur, a Hezbollah commander, And it should be noted that several other people were, of course, killed or injured in these strikes. So the first question we have about these strikes is, how significant were these strikes?
These were very significant strikes, and they all came within a six-hour span. It started with the attack on Beirut on the highest-ranking Islamic resistance, meaning the armed wing of Hezbollah, the highest-ranking general there. He's basically the commander-in-chief, Martyr Sayyid Shukr. And then it was followed by an attack by the American Air Force on the popular mobilization units in Iraq, targeting their drone unit. And then it was topped off with the assassination of the political bureau chief of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh. So you could see that this was all coordinated. It had a specific goal, which is to take out some very big names within the axis of resistance and to signal to the axis of resistance, to the Palestinians and to the world, that there would be no negotiations to end the genocide in Gaza. And of course, when you kill the chief negotiator, Ismail Haniyeh, you're giving that signal. And when you're killing the head of the military wing of Hezbollah, you're basically saying, come and get me, let's go to war. And these individuals, although they will be replaced, and these organizations like Hamas and Hezbollah have withstood tens of assassinations over the decades and have organized themselves in ways that the loss of a leadership does not affect the continued activities of the organization, we can't, of course, undermine that these individuals have had huge contributions to the struggle, whether it's General Shukr of Hezbollah, who was one of the founders of the military wing and led the battles in 1982, in 2000, in 2006, in 2014 in Syria, and even was involved in providing support to the Bosnian population during the Srebrenica and Yugoslavia wars. So this is a man of huge contributions to building the capabilities within the axis of resistance and the whole region as a whole of resisting imperialism. And definitely Ismail Haniyeh was a towering figure within the Palestinian community, and his humble and a very lovable approach in how he spoke to his people and spoke to the world about Palestinian liberation is going to have a huge impact, his absence.
Yeah, it's incredible to think of the experience that both these individuals have. But of course, as you mentioned, there are tens of other examples where it has happened, and there are many folks who are ready to step up and stand in line next. So following on that, I wanted to also ask, related to these strikes in Tehran, some analysts had speculated that Israel and Netanyahu, in effort to eliminate the Hamas and Hezbollah leadership, also in line with their claims that they are just trying to eliminate Hamas and Hezbollah and not seeking to target civilians. Whereas other analysts believe that these strikes were in fact an attempt to get Hezbollah and Iran to respond in kind in hopes of drawing the US into the war. But what is your analysis?
Well, it's clear that we can kind of put all these events in a row, and let's see how it looks like. So we had Netanyahu go to the United States, meet with all the political wings of the empire, Biden, Kamala Harris, and Trump, before he even met with the Imperial Senate Congress joint meeting. And he got clearly an approval to stand in front of the Congress and speak about a war between civilization and barbarism, asking to give as much weapons as possible and as fast as possible so we can finish the job as fast as possible. These are the words of Netanyahu, that the Zionist colonies fighting the whole axis of resistance in Iran on behalf of the United States, so the U.S. Soldiers could be safe, and is fighting on behalf of Europe and the whole civilized West, and got the most standing ovations of in history in the United States. Of not even any American president received that many standing ovations for that long. So, and within day of him arriving back in occupied Palestine, these actions of attacks in Lebanon and Iraq and Iran happened. So this is like an indication of approval by the United States that this was all planned. The Americans admitted that they were the ones behind the assassinations in Iraq, and the Iranian government just released their report yesterday about the assassination in Tehran, and said that this was a joint operation of special forces between the United States and Israel that was landed a group inside Iran and made their way into Tehran, where they fired an ATGM, a guided missile, on the residence where Ismail Haniyeh was staying during the night of the day of the inauguration of the new president of Iran. So these were all provocations. The United States is the empire. The Zionist colony is just a vessel. Anyone that thinks that Netanyahu can drag anybody in the U.S. into war or can control the American government is out of their mind. The Zionists are just good house slaves, okay, of the empire, and they are offering the blood of Jewish Europeans as a sacrifice for that imperial position and favor. So the truth is, already the American Navy was on the way before these attacks were happening. A landing amphibious fighting group in the Eastern Mediterranean was making its way before any attack happened on Lebanon. And now we see the massing of American aircrafts, squadron after squadron is arriving in the region. And that all shows you that this was not only Netanyahu wanting to drag the U.S., yeah, sure, but the U.S. wanting it to happen. Because you have to look at it as in a bigger context. The Zionist colony is the jewel in the crown of imperialism. It is the most important geopolitical position in the whole world. It's the knot that controls all trade. It's the doorway to Asia and Africa and Europe. It's where all communication and cultural exchange traditionally in the world happened. So holding that, added to it, of course, is all the mythology of Judaism and Christianity and Islam that the empire wants to control and those who follow those religions. So the United States will never give up the Zionist colony, except it's the death throes of empire. And that's what we see right now. The U.S. is going to fight this war. If it breaks out fully, the U.S. is prepared to sacrifice American soldiers, not because it's for on the altar of Israel or something like that. No, it's for the altar of imperialism. This is probably a better way to look at it than thinking it's just Netanyahu trying to pull the U.S. into a war. Yeah, sure, he needs the U.S. imperial power now to defend him because he lost the battle on the ground against the Palestinian resistance in Gaza. He lost the war against Hezbollah in the air. He lost the war against Ansarullah in Yemen in the sea. And the only thing now that's keeping the Zionist colony from collapse is the direct American involvement that's coming now in this war.
That was Beirut-based journalist Laith Maarouf speaking on the Activist News Network. Laith's website is freepalestine.video. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Steve Seltzer, Polina Vasilyev, and myself, Ann Garrison. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at Pacifica CRD. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.